Boo!
In honor of Halloween, what is 2018's most best movie-related Halloween costume? Most movie-related could also be the answer, but it's really best movie-related Halloween costume, in your opinion.
Sorry, I made the mistake. I'm Katie Rich. I'm an adult who didn't have a costume, so I'm going with something stolen from the Twitter feed of Demi Adiju-Ebay, Electro Lemon, who suggested Jackson Maine, spelled M-A-N-E, long hair, red bloated face, guitar, diamond earring studs, ice cream face tattoo.
I'm Matt Patches, and my recommendation for anyone who's actually dressing up this Halloween would be to dress as either Freddy Krueger or Jason Voorhees from the 2018 blockbuster Ready Player One. Remember that? Remember that movie?
Beloved blockbuster.
Remember those characters?
Oh, boy. I've done Steven Spielberg the favor of not remembering that movie, but when it comes on cable... if God forbid it goes to HBO or Showtime, the two premium movie channels I get, then I'm fucked because I'm going to be like mainlining that movie like I do everything else they show. I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with a group costume. I want to see a bunch of people go as the dancers from Helena Marcos's Dance Academy in Suspiria. Wait, in the red like stringy dress things that you can see them wear in the trailer, or they also, of course, wear in the movie. And then one person, of course, needs to go as Tilda Swinton by way of Marina Abramovich as Madame Blanc in the long gray robes and even almost as long ponytail or braid.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 236. It's the week of October 31st. Woo! And on this day in 1961, Peter Jackson was born. Who knew that Peter Jackson had a Halloween birthday?
Spooky.
And, I didn't even know that Peter Jackson was born.
Because Bat Patches chose the trivia this week. 2 years later, Rob Schneider was born. That is something Dave never would have picked on this day in history.
That is true.
We don't have Dave with us this week.
Do you think at parties when people talk about their birthdays with Peter Jackson and they're all like, oh, who was born on your birthday? He happily cites Rob Schneider.
Yeah, probably.
Cool. He's like, yeah, I got Deuce Bigelow.
Yeah. What can Peter Jackson be prouder of in his life?
I don't know. I got Jon Favreau, not the Pod Save America guy, but sadly the filmmaker behind, I don't know, Zathura, the upcoming Star Wars series that nobody wants.
The Lion King.
Wait, who do you have, Katie?
I have Pauline Kael, so take that. I'm fancy. Also, Garfield the Cat.
Garfield the Cat has a birthday?
Yeah, every year he gets like a series of like birthday week comics about him. It's very satisfying. Who do you
I also have Jason Reitman,
you
which
have Marilyn
is more
Monroe,
unfortunate than not.
I have Marilyn Monroe and Alanis Morissette, and I'm pretty happy with that.
Those are two solid Geminis. Anyway, Dave's not here. We'll find out next week who shares his birthday. There's no reason he's not with us. He's just not here. But I hope you all listened to the mega mix he got together of Charlie playing with the Star Wars toys last week.
Wait, where is he? I don't know where he is.
He's having.
Do you have the scoop?
No, you changed the recording night, and Dave was busy.
Fair enough.
That is the scoop.
Ooh, interesting story. Go
inside
on.
Inside baseball in honor of the World Series. That's an inside baseball.
I did not know it was the World Series. I think that's an appropriate thing to say on our movie podcast. I had no idea it was happening. I didn't know who was playing.
I mean, it happens every October.
Could not have told you that. Is that sad?
No, I mean, do you know who's playing now? Do you
couldn't have. Could you not have named what month the World Series takes place in?
Nope. I would have said September.
Well,
go Mets. Go
dumb.
Mets. I'm sorry. I got other things on my mind. Like Sabrina.
I could not be less interested
in baseball,
talking about
this week.
But no. I'm alive on the earth. Anyway.
It's just there's a lot going on in the world. How can you?
So like how every June, I'm like, oh, the Stanley Cup happens in June. That's
I will
weird.
Say this.
I mean,
baseball
there's
fever
so
is
much
real.
Going on in the world right now that I watched the baseball game last night. I guess it was game 4, just because it was something
that wasn't the news.
That actively awful. It was boring. But
although Trump was tweeting about the baseball game.
I did not learn that until today, that Trump had tweeted about the baseball game, opining, lending his 2 cents, because, of course, he is also the world's best baseball manager.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
World's greatest, yeah. Well, just to be fair, I did read an article about baseball today that I highly recommend in the New York Times about Japanese baseball bats being made into chopsticks. Great story. I actually read a story from the sports section of the Times. I feel very proud. Proud enough to say it on a podcast.
In Japan, and it is way more fun than it was here.
Wow.
Anyway.
And a really informative intro segment because we have no reviews.
Yeah,
to read.
No reviews.
If you don't leave us reviews, I'm just going
to
say
section.
Inane things about Japanese baseball.
Leave us a review about how much you hate this intro instead of reviews. And
make it five stars, please.
Yeah, leave us some reviews, and we promise we'll bring Dave back.
On to our spooktacular Halloween
Titanic segment.
Oh, right.
So, I know a lot of podcasts are doing this right now, but we like everyone else, like Serial Season 3, like Pod Save America, are devoting the first segment of our podcast this week to the James Cameron film Titanic. Not because
Sarah Koenig did it first, we're going to do it better.
Right. Not because our country hit an iceberg and it's been sinking, it's been on TV pretty much constantly since, I'd say, mid-1998 or late 1998, about a year after it came out in theaters.
Where has it been ever since? Is it playing?
Well, I'm
going
to get there, Patches. I'm going to get there because I have a very specific answer to that question. But I've been watching it on TV. I vividly remember, like, being late for karate when I was, like, 15 one Saturday morning, back when I did karate, because I was watching Titanic on TV. And here we are. I'm 34. Still watching Titanic on TV. But something happened, I think, in the beginning of October where the rights lapsed. It was like a cable TV staple for a long time, and now Showtime has claimed it, or it's like they've recycled it. It is on Showtime or Showtime 2 all day, every day, but it is also at the same time, and often literally at the same time, so that you can, as I did over the weekend, picture in picture, two different channels showing Titanic on E for their like Movies We Love series. And also on Ovation, I found it. And on both those channels, of course, it's playing with commercials and stretched out to like 5.5 hours.
And this is why nobody has cable anymore, you realize. Like, you are like hunting down Titanic on channels.
This is why I will never be able to get rid of cable, because I, who like struggle with, and we'll talk about Filmstruck later in the show, struggle with Netflix, struggle with these, sort of a la carte, actively choosing what you want to watch things. Like, I was raised, my brain deformed over the years by having all these options sort of laid out with me and passively watching the same movie over and over and over again, coming into it at different points. It's something that I cannot quit, even though I can feel my life slipping away as I watch Titanic for the fifth time this weekend.
What do you see? I mean, we have something else in store in this segment to get to, but I am curious what value you get out of watching it that many times over and over and over again. Are the leads just that charismatic?
There's definitely a tipping point, pun intended, but I think, straight ahead. Yeah,
right
this is an opinion I've held for a very long time, and I know that Katie agrees with me. I think this is foundational to our friendship. I think this is one of the single greatest movies ever made, and certainly one of like the most important, iconic. I mean, inarguably one of the most iconic, but one of the most resonant for me pieces of entertainment from my lifetime. It is a movie that keeps on giving. I think it really captures the grandeur of a lot of the classic melodrama and epics that it was trying to tap into, but also with the chutzpah, the special effects, the egomania, and so on, that makes James Cameron, Mr. Cameron, who he is, and on a planet on his own. It also makes me feel, even if Avatar wasn't entirely your cup of tea, that, like, you just don't doubt James Cameron. All these people are like, oh, Avatars 2 through 5? Listen, I am also skeptical, because that sounds insane. But at the same time, is James fucking Cameron. If anyone, yeah. if anyone on earth.
No one ever got rich telling James Cameron that he didn't know what people wanted to see.
Exactly. I mean, like, it's just insane to me that people are voicing. I mean, to be skeptical is one thing, because anyone mounting this sort of project right now, especially after Avatar, may not have knocked your socks off, even though I quite liked it. Certainly has not stayed with me in the way that Titanic has. But Titanic is just like, there's so many, and this is a great segue into what we're going to be doing in this segment. There are so many little moments of Titanic. It's beyond the scale of it and the grandeur of everything. There's so many little moments, a lot of them written into the very underappreciated screenplay that James Cameron wrote for this, that I find that resonate with me and continue to pop up and always feel like new discoveries, the same way that listening to a favorite album, you sort of always hear new things. There's a great beat where, you know, of course, Jack teaches Rose how to spit like a man. And then a couple hours later, when the ship is sinking, hours later in movie time, not in real life, and she is grabbed hold of by Cal, Billy Zane, she spits in his face to get away from him, which is not just a defensive maneuver, but it's a really clever callback to what it is that, you know, that separates those two men and what it is that she took from Jack and appeals to her about him. I just thought it was a little moment that's really indicative of how clever and how every rivet of this massive movie is well
You're sealed. Puns. Puns.
And so, in honor of the fact that I've been watching it so much, and to sort of pay credit to all the little moments in this movie that sing, Katie and I are going to do a quote off from Titanic. We have
and to be clear, I have not been watching this all weekend. I did not rewatch this movie recently, so I have stepped up to this plate confident in how many times I've watched Titanic, but I don't know, man. You've been mainlining it so much.
I have been mainlining it, but I also have a shit memory that is deteriorating rapidly in my old age. So
my brain is mostly Titanic quotes.
Fair enough. So we're on level playing field here. We're going to feed each other a part of a quote, and then it will be the other person's responsibility to finish that quote. For instance, if I said, Katie.
Yeah.
When Rose says, I don't see what all the fuss is about. It doesn't look any bigger than the Mauritania. What does Cal Hockley say in response?
It's not over 100 times larger than the Mauritania, but it's
100 times would be a really big fucking ship.
Yeah, it's over some number of times larger than the Mauritania and far more luxurious.
The judge is going to give it to you. You missed my favorite part of the quote, which is when he says, "You can be blasé about some things, Rose, but not about
Titanic." Oh, that's true. And then he says, that is one of your favorite lines.
I mean, they're all my favorite lines, but that's one of them. And then he says, "Yes, it's over 100 feet longer than the Mauritania and far more luxurious."
I'm going to give you a line and you have to interrupt me when the time comes to interrupt me. Okay. You ever been to Wisconsin? I grew up there near Chippewa Falls. They have some of the coldest winters around. Me and my dad, we used to go ice fishing. Ice fishing is where, you know,
I know what ice fishing is.
There we go. I did that from memory. My sister used to recite that scene on long car rides.
Who says that line?
Rose.
It's Jack.
Jack DeRose. Oh,
that's when he's like monologuing to her to get her not to jump off the back of the boat.
That is, ironically, the one scene in all of my constant Titanic rewatching recently that I have not seen, because I always happen to come on the movie either like right before that happens and like I'm not paying attention or right after it. But who could forget that line? Let's see. Let's see what else. Okay. Classic lines here. Let's see. Okay, here's an easy one, Katie.
Okay.
Rose says, "Don't you understand? The water is freezing and there aren't enough boats. Not enough by half. Half the people on the ship are going to die."
You love your cow lines.
I did get two cow lines.
Not the better half.
That's true. That was a softball.
I'm gonna have you just, this isn't a call and response. You just have to complete this monologue.
Okay.
"It's been 84 years and I can still smell the fresh paint. The china had never been used. The sheets had never been slept in. Titanic."
Titanic was the ship of dreams to everyone else. To me, it was a slave ship.
Oh, no, you jumped ahead too far. She gets that later.
Oh, wait, hold on. Titanic?
Titanic was a ghost ship. Ghost ship?
Nothing but a steaming pile of ghost ship. let's see. She says, the china had never been used.
The sheets had never been slept in.
The sheets had never been slept in. I have no idea.
Titanic was called the Ship of Dreams.
Oh, and it was. It really was.
I thought she said, yeah.
Oh, I thought that's what she said at the beginning of the
book. No, later on she talks about it being a slave ship when after the whole Martini.
Like, Titanic was the Ship of Dreams. It was. It really was. I mean, come on. That's like our children come out of the wombs knowing that line. But like,
it's been 84 years is my favorite gift.
It's been 84. Do you want me to tell this story or not?
That's so playful. Even in her old age.
Should we pause for Patch's moment? Go ahead, David.
One more round of peace, then we can wrap this up.
Come back to Titanic, as we always do.
Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, this will hardly be our last segment on Titanic. I'm not going to do another Cal line. Let's do another Old Rose line, where Bill Paxton says, "We never found anything on Jack. There's no record of him at all."
Oh, you want me to do the whole thing?
Yes.
No, there wouldn't be, would there? I don't know what she said in the middle. Then she goes, "He exists now only in my memory." And that's her last line of the movie.
The judges are going to give it to you because you got the first part of the speech and the money line.
Yeah, "He exists now only in my memory."
Every time, and then you realize that when she dies, all trace of Jack Dawson will die with her.
And it's the last line of dialogue in the movie, as far as I can tell. And you see technically, her drop the thing off.
Well, technically, her last line is, as she drops the heart of the ocean.
Although you, I assume...
She makes an audible,
Oh, my
God.
You've
seen the clip. You've seen the scene they filmed where Bill Paxton comes out and talks to her in that moment.
What's amazing about the deleted scenes from Titanic...
They're all awful.
I mean, they were deleted for a reason.
Yeah, but it's like James Cameron, for someone who had the good sense to identify how all of these scenes were utter nonsense that would have torpedoed the movie, you would think that he would have had the good sense not to write and shoot them in the first place.
No, but see, he is the master of simplicity. He's the master of foundation. I think this is why Avatar works. He will write every scene you need just in case. And I think a lot of Avatar has a lot of expositional scenes that were completely destroyed too, and he wants to make sure he has them in the editing room in case his movie doesn't make any fucking sense. He can put in these scenes where he just explains everything, but he knows when he can strip them away too, so he shoots them for
coverage. That's a good credit.
Although I will say that I the one deleted scene that I think could have and maybe should have been in the movie is this bit where Rose walks into, it's like before, maybe it's after their date or before their date. She walks down into third class and everyone is sort of looking at her. It must be before their big dinner date when she goes dancing with them. She walks down and everyone sort of like looks at her warily, and Fabrizio is flirting with this Norwegian girl. We see her later, but she has a much beefier part in the deleted scenes. And there's just, it's a really nice moment of like, it answers the question of like how they met back up, but it really does do a good job of better articulating the difference between the two classes and how much of an outsider she may have felt there. I mean, all that stuff comes through in the movie, so maybe it was redundant, but it's a nice moment. Anyway, Katie, give me one last quote.
Okay, last one. I don't want to tell you speaking. "You have a gift, Jack. You do. You see people."
I see you.
You got the shin in, Jack.
It drives me crazy that rhymes. It's always driven me crazy. I think you're right that the screenplay is better than people give it credit for callbacks and things like that. Like, you see the car that they have sex in being loaded onto the boat when they're getting there.
Oh, my God, yeah.
But there are some dialogue moments that have always bugged me when I was 13.
Really? When do you see the car?
It's in the big scene in Southampton. Like, you just see it being loaded in on a big platform.
And the license plate on it is sex, so you know that it's foreshadowing.
It has the handprint already. Like,
Pussy Wagon was written on the back.
Just the moral of the story, or the takeaway of the segment, rather, is that you should never trust anyone who is blasé about Titanic, the boat, or even, in particular, the movie.
You can be blasé about some things, America, but not about Titanic.
Yeah, really one of the great movies of our time. Watch it on Showtime, Showtime 2, Ovation, or E!
the end of the year, and it's time to start catching up on all the things that you've missed as the year has gone on. And luckily, one of them is really easy to find, and it's on Hulu. It's a documentary called Minding the Gap that I happily knew was a... I knew it was a documentary, I knew it was about skateboarding, and I knew that I should see it, but I kind of didn't know anything else. So as I've been watching it, and full disclosure, I have yet to finish watching it as this happens, which happens when you watch movies at home.
I've been watching
it with my small child, which was weird, to realize that it's made by this filmmaker who has been basically filming his childhood friends skateboarding since they were like 11. And somehow at some point he was able to make it into a full blown feature film. But I don't know how, and maybe David can explain it to me. But it's really intimate and it's really kind of loose. And as far as I get, it looks like it's going to travel really far in the future, which is really intriguing. I don't know. I'm kind of discovering it as I go. So I almost don't want to talk too much about it. And I'm really enjoying it.
I would emphasize that, yes, it starts off as a skateboarding documentary, but I think it would be kind of false to classify this as a, like, skating documentary. I wouldn't
want
to turn people off if they're not into the sport.
I give zero shits about skateboarding, and I find this movie fascinating.
Yeah, this movie is very much about, I think they're in Colorado, I want to say they're...
No, they're in Illinois.
Like the Rockford Peaches.
Boulder later? Okay. So they're in
Illinois. Yeah, one of the guys.
That's what confused me.
Colorado, first.
But they're in the kind of in the Rust Belt. They're in a town that is struggling economically, and these kids just found each other through the sport of skateboarding, and beyond that, they came together because they all seem to face violence in their homes. They're all facing...
Well, maybe not because, but like, it seems like it almost was a coincidence that given the circumstances they were all living in, they all grew up around domestic violence.
All kind of retreated into this group and bonded. And the film, Bing Lu, is the filmmaker, but also one of the skaters, and has gone through some serious trauma in his life. His father was abusive, or was it? Yeah,
stepfather
towards his mother, towards him. And, you know, it was a traumatic experience that he's lived with for a long time and is finally dealing with through this film in a way. But he discovers too that his friends have gone through similar experiences, and this movie begins as a skateboarding documentary and blossoms into following three strands, himself and the two friends, as they navigate, try and not necessarily escape their worlds, but reckon with it and grow. And it goes well for his one buddy who is trying to find a job, is trying to stabilize his life, is trying to help his mom, who is also in bad relationships time and time again. And the other guy who they're close with, who's a little older than them, is struggling with his relationship. He's just had a kid. He's like 22 and just had his first kid with his girlfriend. And he, I mean, I don't want to get... spoiler is the wrong word. Spoiler is not the wrong word, but he risks becoming the kind of toxic masculine presence that a lot of these boys have dealt with their entire lives. And it's really startling because he is both aware of it and completely reckless. David, do you think skating factors into their lives? I find the way that the movie structures the skate footage and the past and present, how they're still engaged with the sport. Maybe it is a skating documentary and I'm not doing it a disservice. Maybe skating is an important part of how these guys are coping and moving forward and growing and learning.
I understand why you would downplay it as a skating documentary. I think, especially because the purpose of the segment is really advocacy more than anything else. There's this incredible film that's waiting to be watched on Hulu, and I think people need a little bit of a push to actually see it. And so I share your understanding, your desire to say it's not a skating documentary. It's even, you know, really less to do with skating than something like mid-90s or Skate Kitchen, even though those movies would make an interesting triptych, this being far and away the best of the three. Far and away. Even though I enjoyed Skate Kitchen and anyway,
mid-90s.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. But like, I want to sort of disassociate this movie from really any other movies about skateboarding, just because I think that, that's really just the tip of the iceberg. I think that if you went to these guys, to Bing Lu, to his friends, and said it's not a skating movie, that they would probably take offense to that for good reason, because skating is obviously so important to their lives. It was such a common interest between them. It was a way out of their houses where there was a lot of toxic male energy. It was a way not out of poverty in the way that some sports might be, but just a way to be free and liberated for a time. And I think that, you know, you also don't want to diminish the role that skateboarding plays in their lives. But yeah, I mean, just a second what Katie said, like, I don't really give a shit about skateboarding. I've never really understood it, despite my attempts with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle skateboard when I was in like third grade.
I want to see footage of that. Give me the found footage documentary based on David's career as a skateboarder.
But I will say, and this movie, though, this is like hardly the movie's chief goal, as just sort of a byproduct of what it's doing, did give me a much better understanding as to the value of skateboarding, and the appeal of it than any other movie I'd ever seen. And it's really just, a symptom of watching the movie. It's not at all what the film is trying to do, first and foremost, but it's just like, it's such
It is the backbone of it. It's the one place that they can be in control of their lives. Like the way that they're guiding the skateboard around these skate parks, it's like they are in control, and it's juxtaposed, I think, pretty perfectly. It's a well-edited documentary with all this old footage and new footage, and you come back to skateboarding, and it's like these guys, it's their zen moment, even when life is horrible.
And the comfort they have around being Lou with the camera as being their friend, like, the intimacy of the documentary I find really impressive, like that he has these guys comfortable around him, but also that he's willing to ask them these questions and ask himself these questions and things that, like, you wouldn't think someone who's just filming their friends would be willing to do. That's kind of the thing I want to know the most about how it became a film, like when that level of filmmaking matured for him.
I mean, I'm sure that there are interviews out there where, you know, Bing Liu gets into the nitty-gritty of how he... Yeah, but, like, I mean, I think it's the power that... I mean, it reminded me a lot of Boyhood, not just in like the scale and of the film and having, you know, watching these people grow up before your eyes and in a much more condensed period of time. I mean, this movie is, it's a little bit longer than a half the length of Boyhood, but, it doesn't really make much of a point of watching these kids age from when they're, you know, preteens or, you know, tweens to when they're in their mid-20s or older. It happens pretty organically.
It's more of like a maturity arc. Like, there's a lot of scenes of the young kids breaking their boards and starting fights and being really pissed off.
Yeah, but then they, like, double back on that. Like, the most powerful scene where somebody breaks his board is when you see his friend. They cut back, like, everyone is sort of chronologically older, but he cuts back to his friend angrily breaking his board when he's much younger, because it recontextualizes everything you sort of understand about his family life and how the anger that he was trying to bury. And but it's also, like, one thing that this movie does, I don't want to slag Boyhood, I mean, obviously they're very different movies that are using, like, not entirely similar means towards very different ends, but a change of perspective that you get from this movie is so radically different than something like Boyhood, where you're sort of always rooted in that kid's POV, and you're just sort of, you know, he gets older, you're looking at him. In this movie, as the kids get up, you sort of feel them looking at each other differently, and we look at them differently, and see not how they're just aging, but as how they're changing as people, particularly his friend, whose name is escaping me right now. I want to say Greg, Keith, I don't know, Greg.
There's Keir.
Zach is the one who moves away and, like, starts working at a deli in Colorado because he has nothing else to do.
Yeah, okay. But yeah, but I mean, like, there's a whole thing with, I mean, in a year full of movies and in a generation full of movies about toxic masculinity, I can't think of any that have really better gotten to the heart of how that takes root and manifests in how you have that duality between especially this movie was reverberating for me after the Kavanaugh hearings, where you have these people who are not just reckoning with these villains, with these evil men, but they're closest friends, and having to sort of grapple with this uglier side that they see in them and trace it to its origins and sort of find the genealogy of this, I don't know, systemic, misogyny and minimalization of these other people and the women in their lives. And, like, the stuff that we see. And watching the filmmaker through his own eyes, through the lens of the camera, having to negotiate with his friend's, the mother of his friend's child about, like, how he's going to broach the subject of the fact that his friend gets drunk and beats her. And, like, you know, we, our sympathies have totally been with this friend at that point in the movie. And then we have to take a step back and really reevaluate how we see all these people and negotiate their circumstances, how they got there. I mean, it's really, powerful stuff. I don't know, Katie, were you as moved by this? Did you?
Yeah. I still have to watch the end of it, so I don't want to like pass the judgment on how moving.
How far are you in it?
I just saw the scene that you're talking about. Like, I got like a little less than half of it left to watch. Which I look forward to doing. It's weird to talk about without seeing it. But the thing that has been striking me so much is what we're talking about, like this kind of frankness about cycles of toxicity and like how these things grow up, and the intimacy and the fact that he's doing this with his friends, with his camera. Like when I was in high school and college, like I filmed my friends with video camera all the time and would have loved me like, yeah, I'll make a documentary about our lives. But I never would have had the courage to.
You should.
To be frank about stuff like this, like to sit down with like your mom or your friend and have those conversations is really astonishing. And it's just amazing to see somebody able to do that.
There's a scene
the scenes where he interviews his mother.
Yeah.
They
double back to that later in the movie, Katie, and I don't think you've gotten there quite yet.
It is a hard thing. I mean, you can feel that it's hard for him to talk to his mother about this stuff, and it's just like it's heartbreaking because he's doing it in the kind of Errol Morris right in her face way of filming.
Yeah, he like sets up a little Interatron in their living room.
And it's like the only interview he does of that.
A combination of skills in a documentary. The like intimacy, the intimate access, and also the kind of unflinching.
Well, he is a student of Steve James, I think. He worked.
Yeah, Carson Quinn
but
produced
He was also a really capable
filmer
long before he ever met Steve James. I mean, like the skateboard footage in this movie is incredible in the way that it only could have been shot by someone who was.
He has a Spike Jones
skateboarding.
Instinct with a Steve James editor's touch, and the movie is a miracle. I mean, it is pretty astonishing.
Yeah.
Watch Minding the Gap.
Yeah, Hulu.
Yeah, it's a hell of a movie, I think.
When you're done Titanic.
When you're done with Titanic, I mean, in between viewings of Titanic, I think.
This is like a palate
cleanser.
It's
a palate cleanser.
Palate cleanser of sorts. But it was for a time, I want to say, free on Hulu. I don't know if it is any more, but it could be. I don't know.
Did they
but
pick it up at Sundance?
Yeah, it was at Sundance. I don't know when they sealed the deal, but it was at Sundance. And it kind of went under the radar. Everyone I talked to saw it, was raving about it, but you know how that goes at Sundance. There's a million things to see. And it really wasn't until it hit the internet over the summer that it popped. But yeah, it's a pretty extraordinary movie. And, you know, thank God that Bing Liu had that instinct and the compulsion to film his friends from such an early age, and not just in the way where you're like, oh, I'm going to go out tonight and take some photos. And like, I'm going to be the guy who does that for a little while. I mean, it's like he spent like a decade and change constantly filming and all of the most uncomfortable and beautiful moments between them. It's really special.
Ooh. Heavy.
So this week, for film buffs, we got some bad news. Filmstruck, the streaming service that was kind of a team up between Turner Classic Movies. Well, actually, I think it was Turner Classic Movies, the streaming service. It just happened to also include the Criterion Collection's extensive library. It had MGM, Golden Age Hollywood Films. Of course, it had Warner Brothers, which owned Turner Classic Movies, or Warner Media. They had their back catalog there. Tons of great films from around the world. TCM has always done an amazing job on the TV broadcast side of airing great films and uncovering rare films to show late at night, usually. But Filmstruck was an amazing enterprise for film people, and it is going away. On November 29th, Filmstruck will disappear from the streaming landscape, and it's unclear exactly what will happen to its assets. So the backstory here is that over the summer, the big Time Warner Inc. and AT&T merger happened. Time Warner became a subsidiary of AT&T. It is now called Warner Media, and Warner Media is basically consolidating, organizing, trying to figure out what it's going to do to compete with Netflix and the Disney monolith that will
They've
have a streaming
They've already announced
service.
Very vague plans for a streaming service.
Yes, in like late 2019, they will have a new streaming service that is going to be, you know, Warner Brothers Pictures. They have Harry Potter. They have the DC films, all that
IP.
They
have Looney Tunes.
Yep, and Warner Television, so Friends and ER, that's all going to disappear from Hulu probably. And the CW shows, all of that will disappear from Netflix, and they'll end up on this Warner Media streaming service. And then HBO is a huge component of what Warner Media wants to do and kind of take on Netflix. Obviously, Game of Thrones is a pillar. There's going to be more Game of Thrones soon. David, are you okay? You're breathing heavily. Are you dealing
with
this?
I'm exhausted.
Everything's just terrible.
Everything is pretty terrible. But yeah, so Filmstruck put up a message on its website thanking the loyal fan base, the customers who helped them, and that was it. That it's going away. And the question is, what does it mean to lose Filmstruck? What does it mean for this enterprise? Like, do you think that Warner Media, I mean, they don't have the best interest of film people who love these classic movies, but is there hope for that catalog to just automatically appear on this Warner Media streaming service? What is lost when we lose something like this? Does it worry you in a macro way? Are these films gone forever? I don't know. Should we be as worried as we are? These things happen. They come and go.
I don't know if we should be worried, if that's the right word, but we certainly have every right to be dismayed and frustrated. It's a huge loss. I mean, finally, we're only so long into the streaming era, but there wasn't really anything that came close to what, I mean, Canopy is an interesting alternative that is working out of public libraries and has a growing library of titles, the kind of movies you might find on Filmstruck. Yeah. But there was nothing really like Filmstruck and the breadth of the titles that they had, but also the curatorial rigor that they used to program their titles, how on the ball they would be about keeping the program fresh, programming fresh, and intelligently
resurfacing things to the front, like having like curated collections,
having intros, having mini documentaries that would talk to you about the making of these films, the history of
films. and you know, having a partner for the Criterion Collection is important as well. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of why Criterion, I mean, this essentially was a proprietary streaming service for Criterion, and maybe they'll be able to develop one in-house going forward. I don't know. But you can like go on criterion.com, and if you're a member, you can log in and hit play on any of the spine numbers, and you can just watch the Blu-ray quality, or close enough right there. But this was a tremendous resource. It really filled a hole that Netflix and Hulu and all the other really major streaming services left wide open. I mean, I made a joke on Twitter the other day when this news came out that if you go in the classic section on Netflix, I mean, and this isn't much of a joke, it's not far from reality, you basically have Clerks. It's like Clerks and like a few old movies in the public domain, like The African Queen.
Which I watched on Netflix somewhat recently. I'm the audience
it's like
for that, I guess.
Not a great, I mean, great movie, but like not a great version of it. And it's pretty much all they got. I mean, they have like Orson Welles' The Stranger, because that's in the public domain as well.
Probably more Orson Welles film soon now that they're releasing a lost one.
The point remains that they real fucking spotty, and I mean, it's just a lot of these movies are no longer going to be accessible to people, and it's just like it's not just the older movies. I mean, the variety of newer movies, really movies of any kind that Filmstruck offered or will continue to offer until the end of November. People already have a subscription. Were a lot of films from foreign countries, a lot of films from emerging cinemas. There was really, I mean, their selection of African films is not overwhelmingly deep, but it's certainly a hell of a lot deeper than anything you're likely to find on the other streaming services. They reflected the biases of the Criterion Collection, but also were able to fill in the gaps with a no fuss, no muss, without having to do a full-blown DVD and Blu-ray release. It was really invaluable, and I don't know what people are going to do to fill that gap. I mean, I wonder if it's going to turn more people, like, you know, capitalism is an ugly thing. It has no moral center, is a quote I've seen used many times today in context of people celebrating the business interests of the, you know, new fascist populist leader of Brazil. Capitalism doesn't care about making films available to you. It doesn't have any sort of, You know, there's
no incentive.
Yeah, there's no incentive. There's no moral incentive to what it's doing. It's not enough for the people at Time Warner to be making these movies available to people. If it's not streamlined for profit, it can't be a loss leader. It can't even be like making just enough to get by. It has to be, a profit driver. And,
right, I think that's
for the love of the game.
That's the big thing that Warner Media has kind of broadcast throughout this whole process. If you recall, when the deal went through over the summer, the CEO, whose name I can look up in 1 second, John Stankey, he did a meeting, kind of a captivated audience meeting at HBO, where he was like, step it up, we need hours a day. It's not hours a week and it's not hours a month. Yeah. We need hours a day. We are competing with devices that sit in people's hands to capture their attention every 15 minutes. And it's like lighting a fire under HBO's ass, as if they're not delivering quality enough programming or being the water cooler conversation enough. They're under fire. So you can imagine what Filmstruck must have been.
And what happens
like
is that, like, you, all of this stuff, all the things that we need to preserve culturally, all of the things that have some sort of inherent virtue to them, that also stand a chance of turning like a decent profit, I'd imagine, need to be saved by like merciful billionaires who happen to be enthusiasts. I was just watching my favorite show on television, Real Sports with Brian Gumbel, and there was a whole segment on this month's show about a billionaire philanthropist who has essentially revived chess in the United States, because he lives in St. Louis and like funded this whole chess championship out of his own pocket. And is essentially like buying all of the world's top chess talent to come to St. Louis. He bribed, you know, paid for this Italian American chess champion to switch his national citizenship to American from Italian and represent America. I mean, like, he's a Republican. He hates taxes. I don't like the guy, but like, it's the kind of person you need, someone with passion who cares about something. It doesn't matter if they're losing money, if they're sinking $50 million into something, to keep these things alive. Otherwise, they're all going to be swept under the surface. We're all going to be like, New York City is going to become one Bank of America after another. I mean, like, you see this manifest in
galaxy braining.
No, I'm just saying it's like, it's all the same. I mean, it's all just about, how the capitalism run amok. It's like, you don't have the people funding the things that matter, because it doesn't serve the bottom line.
I mean, you're absolutely right. The comment that Turter and Warner Brothers Digital Networks, I don't actually know what that is, but that's who joined in with Turner to give me an official statement when this news broke. They said, while Filmstruck has a very loyal fan base, it remains largely a niche service. We plan to take key learnings from Filmstruck to help shape future business decisions in the direct-to-consumer space and redirect this investment back into our collective portfolios. Okay.
Can anyone teach them how to speak like a human? Good Lord.
I don't think they want us to know what that means.
They're speaking to their shareholders.
But that was speaking to the media. Like, you got to come up with someone who can.
Yeah, but they're speaking to their shareholders through the media.
Hey, I'm not used. I can't be used. But what do you think? Do you think that there are key learnings from Filmstruck? Is there a way? I think of Filmstruck. So Warner Media also owns Crunchyroll, which is the biggest like anime provider.
Crunchyroll's great.
And I wonder if there are key learnings from Filmstruck. Finding niche audiences and maybe bringing them into the fold. Maybe we should be more hopeful that Filmstruck could provide a backbone to a way to lure people into the larger entity that will be this WarnerMedia streaming service.
I mean, everything is going to become more niche as time goes on. I mean, like, there are and we see this. I mean, I don't want to get too galaxy brain again, but I don't think it's far removed from the conversation about like the ratings of Oscar telecasts or anything like that. Like, everyone, as the internet takes hold and a new generation comes in to use it, I mean, like, interests are so stratified. They're so diverse. You're going to have more people watching more things, which means fewer people watching any one thing. And, like, you know, occasionally you have this unicorn who is able to bring everyone together, like when Adele drops a record and, like, every single – it's a 12-quadrant, which doesn't really make sense, 4-quadrant hit. But, you know, it's those things are few and far between, and I think that finding a way to healthily monetize niche things and make sure that people have access to the things that they care about is important. And you can't just rely on some benefactor billionaire who is going to, fingers crossed, have the same interests and, you know, single-handedly keep those niches fed.
Katie, we have talked about Filmstruck in the past because we have been using it to show our kids old movies. It's been a great mm-hmm. way. I mean, I was just watching Unsinkable Molly Brown with my
daughter
really? Today.
Yes. On my endorsement?
On your recommendation. A movie that I would never buy. Like, I wouldn't own that movie. Mm-hmm. I have no mm-hmm. investment in it, but I'm looking at old musicals. That's one I haven't seen, but it's very popular. Debbie Reynolds, love her. Let's watch
Strong
this movie.
Strong female character?
Yeah. Well, she does want to find a husband and who's rich, so that
but she's
starts
like,
up.
she busts balls that whole movie.
She does bust a lot of balls. But that's like, I needed it on my fingertips to find it. And perhaps yep. Netflix yep. just sent me, it's funny, Netflix sent me an email the day Filmstruck announced that it was going under, reminding me that I had canceled my Netflix disc account, which I did a while ago, because I had Filmstruck,
vultures.
To be honest. Yeah, and they were like, 1 month free. And I guess that's my, I have to go back to disc. But what I want to ask you, Katie, is since we show our kids old movies and we're invested in that, will you buy more now? Will you buy physical
so
media
I
again?
I've been thinking about buying physical media, not so much for old movies because I didn't think about Filmstruck going under and like being able to like show Charlie 10 minutes of Unsinkable Molly Brown before he like gets bored and walks away. Like that's something that even buying the physical media, like I'm not going to be convinced to do that. But I've been thinking about it with this thing that went around a while ago where someone in Canada had bought a movie on iTunes and then iTunes was like, actually, we don't have that anymore. So goodbye. It's not yours anymore. And, you know, we bought The Lion King on iTunes because we could have it on the iPad for when we fly. And I'm like, okay, but do I really own The Lion King? And I think I want to start building like a family movie physical media library that eventually could like include bigger stuff. Like right now, like to get Charlie to focus on something for more than 50 minutes is hard. So I'm not going to start like buying the red shoes for him. But yeah, I think I am going to have to start buying more physical media. Cause like for me, there's enough for me to catch up on with what's on Hulu, on Netflix, on screeners. Like I don't worry about that. But in terms of like introducing kids to cultural things of cultural value, I think physical media is the only way you can count on it.
Yeah. And I also worry that or wonder if these movies are not readily available to people and sometimes not available to people who are willing even to pay for them. I mean, if there are a lot of films, I did a whole gallery of 50 films on IndieWire when this news broke that are not available on Criterion DVD or Blu-ray that may sort of disappear or not be able to like be legally watched in some way for a while.
What are one or two off the top of your head? I'm just curious. You know. okay, we'll click through.
Blu-ray. There may have been a Blu-ray made available recently, but like Ken Russell's The Devils, for example.
Gotcha,
a great film that's on Filmstruck that is not on Criterion DVD or Blu-ray. They may have released a Blu-ray of it recently by another company, I'm not sure. But that's one that comes to mind. I wonder like what's to stop people from downloading these movies illegally, because you can find, if you know where to look in the click of a few buttons, 1080p qualities that have been ripped from some Blu-ray or some restoration or whatever, even like 576p things that were ripped from God knows where, but are watchable, of pretty much anything under the sun. And if companies are not going to provide legal means for you to exchange money for the access to these films, I mean, I wonder if it's going to only exacerbate a culture of torrenting, which is not ultimately good for anybody. And because there's a hunger for these movies, and maybe it's not enough of a hunger to sustain something with like Filmstruck, which sounds absurd because I can't imagine their overhead was that crazy, but at least under AT&T, Time Warner's eyes. But you know, there are these people who need access to those movies who have essentially been conditioned to expect it as long as they pay a decent fee. And now that access can be taken away. I mean, like the interest is not going to go away with it, at least not for the current crop of cinephiles. I mean, the absence of something like Filmstruck might hinder the, as you guys are talking about, the creation of new movie lovers going forward, and new generations of movie lovers. But, I mean, I think this is a huge incentive for people, whether we like it or not, to go to the torrent sites.
Yeah, I mean, even if you can make an ethical argument for why torrenting will be fine in the future to find these movies, and I think you could, it's not good for the culture at large, weaning people, you know, you don't want to be weaned on torrent culture because then you'll pay for nothing. You won't want
well,
to.
Well, no, and we can't, no, and especially in regards to the next new generation moviegoers, because if we condition, I don't know about people Charlie's age, but like, you know,
what does Charlie use to download illegal content, yeah. Katie? Kazaa?
But if we condition,
oh, yeah, he's big into throwbacks.
If we condition kids to like to think about movies the way that a lot of kids think about music right now, where like they, you know, a lot of kids think that it's absurd to pay for music, that they can either stream it for free or download it for free, stream it for, you know, as part of their subscription service to Spotify. Yeah, but if they think that like they shouldn't have to pay for movies, then it's going to get a lot harder to, I don't know, sustain the viability of movies.
I think that's
we
right.
don't have the same solutions that the music industry has found because it's a fundamentally different product.
To wrap up here, I think we're wrapping up here.
Yeah.
We're probably good to wrap up here. But let me ask you one question. Did you watch anything on Filmstruck that you would not have seen without Filmstruck?
I watched Guys and Dolls. Which I had, you know, was like vaguely familiar with the musical, but watched it because Charlie wanted to watch it. I watched Meet Me in St. Louis, which I never would have prioritized otherwise. I was halfway through, I guess I could still finish it. I'm still halfway through the 1934 Stars Born. All the Stars Borns are on there. So yeah, I mean, I'll everything on Filmstruck. I like, except for Unsinkable Molly Brown, which I grew up watching and I've seen 100 times. But like tons of stuff on Filmstruck I never would have seen otherwise.
I forgot. I just watched The Stars Born 1954, which is
it's so good.
3 hours long, and on at least the cut on Filmstruck, I know it wasn't released this way, but it's the one patched together with still images. It's very peculiar.
Oh yeah, it's weird.
It's a very strange viewing experience, but worth it.
There are a lot of great old Japanese samurai movies.
So many,
like Samurai Spies. Like, I mean, Samurai Spies is actually in the Criterion Collection, but there are like Gonzo the Spearman and stuff like that, which is not in a Criterion or on Eclipse. Is there? There are a lot of old Godzilla movies and Japanese monster movies. There are a lot of like Mikio Naruse films and Masahiro Shinoda films that are not available on Criterion or Eclipse films, like Flowing, that are beautiful and also like landmark works of Japanese cinema that have just not made their way to Criterion's main line. So that's definitely a great resource for those kind of movies.
I was going to mention that I've watched a lot of short films on Filmstruck that I have no idea if you can find them. I watched, there's a bunch of Jane Campion films, short films on there, and I watched Andrew Haig, director of 45 Years and Weekend. He has his short films on there, and I thought that was a real learning experience. I really enjoyed that, and I think the biggest thing that I discovered on Filmstruck was the Ilya Kazan film, A Face in a Crowd, in the Crowd.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Which was that's perfect the one time that's like to watch a horrifying that. Metaphor for our current politics, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So Andy Griffith is playing this bumpkin guy.
It's less of a metaphor than like a straight up prediction of.
It really is. Exactly. I mean, he becomes. Right now. The end of the movie is just like fascism at the top of a sky rise. It's really just terrifying. But Andy Griffith is phenomenal in the movie, and Walter Matthau's there scowling, and I felt. Walter Matthau is my spirit animal now, for sure. But yeah, there's so many good movies on Filmstruck. You have 1 month to watch some of them, and it sounds like a lot of people, like IndieWire and such, are reporting on what you should see. So get watching, and hope that Warner Media maybe comes through and puts a lot of this stuff on their future site. And if not, I don't know, dude.
Producing...
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. Dave will come back. We assume. We hope. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, senior entertainment editor at Polygon.com, where they're talking a lot about Red Dead Redemption, something we're probably not going to talk about on this podcast, unless Dave plays it. I guess I have an Xbox One. I can play it, right? I shouldn't be asking you guys. I'll ask. Polygon.
I think it might be a PlayStation
4. No. You're thinking of Spider-Man. I'm pretty sure. I know my shit here. Red Dead. Because everyone's talking about it coming to PC. I can obtain this game. I can play this game.
Yes, it is.
Once I'm done Mario Tennis.
Rockstar would never go. I guess these days Rockstar. That's why their games make like $1 billion
in 3 days. Anyway, we also have a website, findinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them, or you can leave your comments about what we talked about today, and we might read them. If we didn't get any reviews, but we didn't get any great comments either, and I might be lying. I haven't actually checked, so I'll have to go do that. But findinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich, senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me writing on the internet at Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find me writing on IndieWire at IndieWire.com. You can find us all together on Facebook, a website that was started by a horny Harvard kid in his dorm room and is now used to promote fascism and genocide across the world.
Ruin the world.
Great. We're there. Fighting in the war room.
I'm Katie Rich. I am not going to keep bringing up horrible world news into my events like David. Everyone go enjoy your weeks, please. You find me at VanityFair.com and on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRach. And we're all on Twitter, where you can tweet us about whatever you want, including global politics. I'm sorry, David. At FITWR. And you can also answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
Something that I should say. What is the... It was about Halloween costumes. I'm going to read it verbatim. What is 2018's best movie-related Halloween costume?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.